Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey y'all, I'm your host Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today is one that we posted on Facebook a few weeks ago, which, if you aren't following us, stop what you're doing and go follow us. After I posted it, I kind of ended up in a rabbit hole of this case, and I haven't came out until today. What started as a normal night in Charleston, West Virginia, left one woman dead on the edge of the river. This is the case of Lynn Priestley. Lynn Priestley was born in 1955 to Blanche and Charles Priestley. I couldn't find much on her life before 1990, but I could tell you that, 1990 was going to be her year. She was working as the assistant director to the Charleston Urban Renewal Authority, which she did follow in her mother's footsteps for a while because she worked at the Charleston's mayor's office. At the time, she was living in an apartment on Somerset Drive. Friday, March 16th, 1990, started out as a typical day for Lynn. She planned on meeting with some friends and her on-again, off-again, currently on boyfriend, Thomas White, at Bennigan's.
Oh, I remember Bennigan's.
Really?
Yeah, it was near Macy's, underneath Macy's, in a sense.
That's how I kind of took it.
And if I'm remembering correctly, before Macy's, it was Lazarus.
Never even heard of that story. She met her friends and had some drinks and made plans to meet later at Spanky's Bar on Canal Boulevard, which after making plans, Lynn and Thomas went to Tidewater Grill, also located in the Charleston Town Center.
I'm really sad that they closed down Tidewater.
I've never ate there,
but from everybody I knew who went there, it was really, really, really good food. And I'm also still really upset about the Chop House closing.
I never ate there either.
Oh, the Chop House had one of the absolute best creme brulees.
Oh, you're speaking my language.
It was so stinking good. But I remember how popping the mall was in the 90s.
I mean, I remember it early 2000s as a kid. It was popping.
Oh, you have no clue. Early 90s, that's where everybody went.
Really?
And it was nothing like having to go in and have to wait a good while to be able to get in to park and things of that nature. It was a big, huge deal. I remember going in there and there was nothing but a candy store in there. And if I was a good little girl, mommy would let me go in there and get candy. I'm trying to think what that name of that candy shop was.
I don't know if I remember a time Danny and Papa had a van that you can make into a full bed, had TV, all that. The travel vans that have the dome on top.
Oh my God, the conversion vans or something like that?
Something like that. Oh, well,
did it have the big plush velvet seats?
No, it was all leather, but we took that to Charleston one day and we tried to get in the town center and this woman was freaking out. And Nanny being Nanny told Mom to drive back around and tell her we went through a car wash and shrank some just so the woman would like freak out again because we had traffic blocked. It was literally the best thing. Which, fun little fact, Lynn actually worked part-time at the Tidewater Grill between 1985 and 1988, which she remained friends with a lot of people who still work there. At least one Tidewater employee said that they saw Lynn and Thomas arrive at 11 p.m. and went to the lounge area of the restaurant. She talked with some other friends of hers that were there. And honestly, like, everything else that took place kind of like varies. But one thing that is consistent is that the couple had a very vocal disagreement.
So, was it ever said, like, what it was over?
I couldn't find anything on it. I guess people just heard them arguing over something. But I do know that at, like, some point, Thomas got up and ended up leaving the Tidewater for, like, 15 minutes.
Any idea what he did?
Nope, just that he came back after the 15 minutes. Now, for those who aren't local, the Tidewater Grill was on Court Street in Charleston, which was minutes away from the judicial annex Lynn parked her car at.
Still there?
No, it's actually a parking garage now, but in like 1990, it was like literally just a flat parking lot in the middle of Charleston.
Do you think I know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Any time frame of their time of what they were at Tidewater?
Sadly, no. From 11 p.m. on March 16th to 12:30 on March 17th, I do know that a Tidewater employee who knew Lynn said that she left the restaurant around 11:15, but other reports said that she left Tidewater closer to midnight. To me, I feel like maybe we should cut that in the middle and say 11:30 to 11:45.
That makes sense.
One thing that I do want to point out is that she left her car keys on the bar in the Tidewater Lounge. That night, she was wearing light blue Jordache jeans with zippers at the ankles, a light blue Jordache either like blouse or jacket, white tennis shoes, and carrying a brown leather handbag.
Oh my God, take me back to the 90s with that right there.
All right, I mean, that is 90s in the best way possible.
Like, Jordache was the jeans.
Really?
Jordache was the jeans, early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, Jordache was the jeans.
At 12:30 a.m. on March 17th, Denzel Shamblin, a security guard at the judicial annex, at this time, he was like carrying out garbage from the back of the building, when he overheard what he described as a verbal argument on the annex parking lot. He later said that his glasses broke earlier that day and he wasn't able to positively identify the people that were involved in the argument.
Okay, so.
Mm-hmm.
No offense to anybody named Betty. We are both blonde Bettys.
Literally.
We have horrible vision.
Basically the same prescription.
Yes. We're just going to both say horrible vision.
Mm-hmm.
How can you break your glasses and be a security guard?
I have no idea.
Because I know how bad our vision is. Mm-hmm. And like, if we take all our contacts or our glasses off or something like that, we can't see 2 feet in front of us.
No, I mean, we would be feeling down like a hallway. Especially with garbage bags and like going, like, no.
Especially in nighttime, especially with how late that is.
Yeah, it makes no sense. And like, I'm almost positive I've had broken glasses before and it was a nightmare.
Yes.
He said that he heard a male and female voice. The female screamed out and he said he saw her run from the annex parking lot and east on Courier Street in front of the old West Virginia Federal Building.
Now, old homeboy here has already said, my glasses broke.
Right.
How in the world could he positively identify a female
I have no idea.
Running?
I have no idea.
Again, we can barely make each other out with our glasses on.
Yeah, literally.
Or it's doing this number. Like, literally, when I'm doing my makeup, I'm up in the mirror.
Yeah.
Trying to do my makeup. Like, more power to anybody.
Yeah, so I don't know, unless his glasses weren't really broke. Kanawha County Deputy Mike Stiltner was finishing his shift as a bailiff and went to confront the male who was involved in the altercation. According to Shamlin, Deputy Stiltner spoke with the man, but he didn't detain him.
Did they say if it was Thomas or not?
No. Deputy Stiltner refused to publicly comment on the incident, stating that he made a full report to the Charleston Police Department. Details of this has actually never been made public.
Oh my God.
Right? According to Lynn's friends, she never arrived at Spanky's Bar. So today, Spanky's Bar isn't open. But in 1990, it was located 2 blocks east and 2 blocks south along Canal Boulevard. The best way I can describe to you like where it is, it's now called Vino's Bar and Grill. And do you remember the hotel from the Sauter children case?
Boo, that is so close to my office. It's opposite end of where my office is.
It's right across the street from there.
Oh, okay. I can get us there.
Yeah. Which, I have to say, if it was Lynn who was seen running, she was actually running in the direction of Spanky's.
Thomas later told authorities that he didn't want to accompany Lynn to Spanky's, and he took a taxi back to his home. He said that he told Lynn's mother, Blanche, that he'd last seen her daughter near the Court Street entrance to the Town Center Mall.
Now, Court, I do want to point this out. During my research, news outlets at the time listed Thomas as her boyfriend, but his exact role in her life was kind of less certain.
What do we mean?
I mean, they were a couple, but at least one of her friends said that she was wanting to break ties and that he apparently wanted more out of their relationship, and Lynn wasn't ready to honestly give it all to him. Lynn told one of her friends, Lynn told this to one of her friends over the phone.
Any clue when the phone call was made?
Oh, you know, just 2 days before her disappearance.
Not suspicious at all.
All right.
Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
The next morning, Thomas contacted her parents just before 10 a.m. He asked if either of them had seen or heard from her. They hadn't. Her mother made several attempts to reach her by phone at her apartment, but there was no answer.
So, while you're explaining everything, Lynn would always answer the phone.
Yeah, always. Like, according to her mom, she was close with both of her parents, and she would call almost every single day.
I call my mom every single day, and when my mom doesn't answer, I'm like, oh, so rude, Debbie.
Oh, I know. As Saturday went on and her parents never got a call, Charles and Blanche grew more and more concerned for Lynn. Around 6 p.m., Thomas went back to the Tidewater Grill to see if any of the employees knew where Lynn was. He said that he was told no one had seen Lynn since the previous night.
Anything about her car keys?
Oh yeah, they actually gave them to Thomas. Not too long after this, her car was found in the Judicial Annex parking lot in the same place it was the previous day.
Lynn's father, Charles, and Thomas went to Lynn's apartment, which also seemed to be untouched since the previous day, just like her car. Her dad, right then and there, decided to contact the Charleston Police Department, who dispatched detectives to her apartment. There were no signs of foul play. Little could really be done beyond the filing of a standard missing persons report.
Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcast.
On the morning of Wednesday, March 21st, 1990, Charleston authorities were making plans to search for Lynn.
Where were they going to search?
They were going to start along the banks of the Canal River, but sadly the search would never end up happening.
How come?
Around 2:30 p.m. and roughly 10 miles away, a fisherman fishing the southern bank of the Canal River near Chesapeake saw what he thought was just a mannequin. And y'all, Courtney and I learned this from Crime Junkie Live.
It's never a mannequin.
So, what he thought was a mannequin was actually Lynn, laying face down a few feet from the water's edge. She was completely naked. The fisherman made his way to the Chesapeake City Hall, which was about half a mile away. City Councilman Austin Wilson and Ed Leonard, an investigator for the Kanawha County Prosecutor's Office, responded to the scene. Leonard quickly guessed that the body had been at the location it was found for 4 to 5 days.
A small amount of blood that was found near the body indicated that death occurred not long before its final resting place. Given the steepness of the embankment at the river's edge, he also guessed that Lynn's body had more than likely been rolled down the embankment from Route 61, which is right next to the river. I drive that a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Also, you probably know the exact spot then. Like, if we could, like, figure out the exact location. Not too long after Lynn's body was found, officers from the Charleston and Marmette Police Department arrived, along with the press and a crowd of curious people.
Like, I have to say this. When it comes to a crime scene, people flock.
Oh, 100%.
To it. You know what kills me?
What's that?
It's like when people are like, everyone has a new fascination with true crime. And I'm like, no, boo.
Yeah, I mean, you are so right. Because, I mean, if you remember from our first episode, the case of Nellie Rand and Elmer Ray Bailey, I mean, people were literally going the next day to the crime scene. They were stealing stuff, like, out of her car.
And not only that, but you remember, too, like, what was so crazy about that was the employees at the Black Knight were literally
directing traffic back there. And then, like, if you think about it, 1930s, you had Harry Powers. People were literally paying money to go into the house, into the garage, where he murdered his victims.
Yes.
So, like, it's not new.
It's nothing new. It's curiosity.
Yeah.
I think, in all honesty, and I could be completely wrong about this, people have fascinations with death.
100%.
People want to see a dead body.
Yeah.
And especially if something of a crime scene and a crime victim.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, myself, from what I have seen, given that we have actually received crime scene photos.
Yeah.
What I have actually witnessed on a body being found. Folks, you do not ever want to witness this.
Yeah, because, I mean, we have seen crime scene pictures from our next case. And literally, when I think about this case, I can only, like, picture the crime scene pictures. Like, they are awful. And they've never been released. So, I mean, you can't, like, go and search them.
Exactly. And, like, another thing too, if you have ever smelled a dead body,
it's not a great smell.
That has laid for days. It is a smell that you will never forget in your life. Like, never in a million years will you forget that. Anything of that nature. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, curiosity, it's human nature. But curiosity also kills a cat, and there's some things in life that you need to protect yourself from.
Yeah. I mean, do we enjoy, like, going to, like, look at crime scenes? Yeah, but we're not going to go searching for a dead body.
Absolutely not.
Well, I mean, I can't say that because I have.
Well, I mean, like, okay, for example, it was on a TikTok. A woman just happened to be recording, and it was for a missing person.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
The police overlooked the area. She found that body within 5 minutes. And even though she went out looking, it was still traumatic for her and things of that nature. I mean, nobody goes, you can go out searching, but at the same time, it's something that you don't ever want to come across. Because I think no matter what, it's going to be trauma-induced a little bit.
Which, I mean, my defense, I did go to, like, a police search where there were, like, dogs and stuff. So, I mean, I wasn't technically searching, but, you know, we did get to search. Yeah. Okay, so back to the story. As traffic slowed to a crawl, basically a stop, Authorities, rescue workers, and members of the medical examiner's office began the slow process of documenting the crime scene and moving Lynn's body up the steep embankment, which to me, like, why not just have traffic stopped?
Only thing I know, I guess it's like anything else, like they want to keep traffic moving, and it's like a car wreck. No matter exactly. What, like,
people are going rubberneck. I mean, I know we would.
That's going right, baby. I mean, I about break my neck sometimes to look. It's like, I know I'm not supposed to, but baby, I'm like,
what's going on?
What y'all doing over there? You find a body?
Literally. An identification was made, but the Charleston Police Department was keeping Lynn's name from the public until her family was notified.
Respect.
Literally. In court, I want to play you this clip that I got from the West Virginia Archives. It's of Sergeant Dallas Staples talking at the crime scene.
And notified authorities. We have recovered the body of a female. We do have an identification, but we're withholding that pending notification of next of kin.
White female, black female?
White female.
What was she clothed?
No.
Any bruises on the body?
Well, the medical examiner staff has been on the scene, made a preliminary investigation.
Even though the body was found only feet away from the river's edge, Ed Leonard said that it did not appear to him that the body ever actually entered in the water. Police made plaster molds of what appeared to be footprints in the area between the roadway and the river. Not only was Lynn found naked, but none of her clothes nor personal items were reported anywhere to be seen. Even though authorities declared a comment on any signs of sexual assault, but unconfirmed reports that have leaked out over the years have definitely hinted that it took place. It's actually rumored that her underwear was found stuffed inside her mouth.
Have they ever confirmed?
No, the Charleston Police Department has never actually confirmed or denied this report. While staying silent on the subject of sexual assault, the Charleston Police Department soon confirmed the cause of death.
What was the cause?
Manual strangulation at the hands of a person or persons.
In the Charleston Gazette, which I'm going to shorten this some, it said whoever murdered Lynn Priestley, they did it by hand, strangling the 34-year-old woman before dumping her body on a steep bank of the Kanawha River, police said Thursday. Investigators are searching for information about where Priestley went after 12:30 a.m. Saturday, the time they now believe she was last seen downtown. The assistant director of the Charleston Urban Renewal Authority, Priestley was found dead Wednesday. Her body was laying face down and nude about 15 feet down a pitched riverbank. Now they went into more than that, but for time's sake, I just cut it down some. When they learned of Lynn's death, many of her friends and co-workers were shocked, and I mean beyond words shocked.
They were concerned about the emotions of the family. There was someone that they knew for the first time that they had been touched by something that they otherwise saw on TV. And it's different when it hits close to home.
Can I just say something? For her to be downtown, to being at Chesapeake, baby, that's a pretty good little distance for her body to end up that far away from where she was last seen to there.
Yeah, I mean, she was between Chesapeake and Chillion, which is, what, 10 miles east?
I'm not even sure the distance of it. Well, it has to be a little bit more than 10 because from the Kanawha County Kroger, Kanawha City Kroger, to Marmet is approximately 6 miles. I want to say. Now I'm really like mad doing that. But then you have Marmet on down. So, I mean, it don't make no sense to me whatsoever how they could have found her body without somebody removing her body and driving it down there and then pushing it down.
I know. And, like, honestly, it makes you wonder, like, how she got from downtown to where her body was found. Because, I mean, did they do it in a car? Where did she get picked up at if she was, like, running?
I mean, it makes no sense.
right? And, like, I want to know who took her there. Because, in all honesty, let's say it might take 10 to 15 to 20 minutes to get from Charleston to the area where her body was found. Because, I mean, in all honesty, it's not that bad if there's, like, not that much traffic. And, I mean, it was late at night, so traffic isn't that bad. You're doing close to 70, to be honest, because no one goes the speed limit through there.
But it also makes you wonder, too, if...
they went through Canal City.
Well, it makes you wonder if they jumped on the turnpike and was able to go down quicker that way, or if they stayed going, like, towards Canal City, to which they would have to go through Marmette and that way to get to where she was. So, I mean, it just kind of makes you wonder, because they would definitely have to do some major looping around to get around to where that is. I'm just really overthinking this because, like...
Welcome to my rabbit hole.
Well, as somebody who is in Charleston, sometimes I'm in Charleston 5 days a week. Sometimes it's just once or twice a week. Definitely, we all know Courtney is in Charleston one time a week. We know that without fail. And as somebody who drives all around that area, nothing is making sense right now. Nothing.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, her body had to be placed there, because we all know, like, for y'all who are outside of West Virginia, the Kanawha River is heavily polluted. Heavily polluted. If you fish from there, catch and release, you cannot keep, because of the amount of chemicals that are in there. And I just feel, with the amount of chemicals, what it does to a fish, what would that do to a human body?
Yeah, which, I mean, luckily she... I don't know if they thought she went into the river, or if they just, like, didn't want to risk them getting into the river themselves.
I would never want to get in that river.
No. So, I mean, God only knows. But her remains were transported back to Charleston, where an autopsy was performed by Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Schofer, who we talked about in other episodes. So the day following the discovery of her body, the Charleston Police Department called a press conference to announce their findings and to address the public.
Well, autopsy was done on the body this morning. Dr. Silver, the medical examiner's office, reports to us that at this time he has determined that the manner of death is strangulation. It appears at this time that it was not a ligature strangling, and appears to have been done by human hands.
So at the press conference, they stopped short of stating whether or not sexual assault had taken place, saying that the issue was too sensitive. Detectives Jack Bishop, Dallas, and Jerry Rife made an appeal to the public for help. They really wanted to talk to anyone who may have saw Lynn after she was seen in front of the federal building. They also announced that a 24-hour 1-800 number would be available for the public to call with any potential information, which anyone who called would remain anonymous.
Anybody called?
Over the weekend, they received at least 30 calls. The Charleston Police Department later said that one female caller had given enough information that was said to be helpful to the case. This anonymous person called the hotline on Thursday, March 22nd, so not knowing who the caller was, the authorities used local media to make a public appeal for the unknown caller to make contact again. By this point, nearly all of the 13 detectives in the Charleston Police Department was working on this case in one shape, way, form.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Although Sergeant Dallas Staples sounded very optimistic about new or useful information coming in, like other unsolved crimes, this case of Lynn Priestley started to grow cold.
As the investigation continued, the same questions kind of started to come up over and over again.
Which, you know what my biggest one is?
What's that?
Why did she leave her car keys at the bar of the Tidewater?
Like, it makes no sense.
Like, did they know if she was intoxicated, if that was the reason why, or...
That, or they were taken away during an argument. It's honestly never been publicly confirmed whether or not if she showed any signs of being intoxicated prior to leaving the Tidewater.
So, like, if the two of them were arguing on the night she disappeared, and... when she disappeared after an argument, it's kind of circling back to the person she was having said argument with.
You're definitely not wrong. I mean, it basically pointing to Thomas and Thomas only.
But also, it must have been loud enough to where you're getting the attention of a security guard.
A blonde security guard.
Oh, blonde Betty.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm not sure. Like, I'm wondering, like, maybe it could have got physical. But also at the same time, homeboy's glasses were broke. How could he see if, like, something got physical? Like, you would literally probably hear a slap or something like that. But I mean, whatever happened between the federal building and Spanky's, like, when she was seen running, like, did she get in trouble? Did someone else pick her up? Did Thomas follow her? But also, if Thomas had to take a cab home, where was his vehicle? And, like...
my mind is...
I've been spiraling on this for 2 weeks.
What if the security guard was a friend of Thomas who helped him get rid of Lynn's body, and he broke his glasses in there to say that he was blind, but he actually witnessed everything, but he had glasses saying that he couldn't fully identify who it was?
I hope you don't think that I haven't thought about this. Like, I have thought, like, this security guard has to know more.
You have to.
Or, like, maybe he tried to break something up. Thomas punched him. That's how his glasses got broke. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to say anything about this because he knows where I work.
I mean, my biggest thing is, how did her body end up? Yeah. Yes, like, I'm sorry, folks. I'm sorry.
I mean, like, someone had to take her there. And, like, where did this murder take place? Like, there is no way it could have taken place in the area where her body was found because it was on a steep incline. Like, I have seen it, and, like,
enough, like, to where somebody couldn't have done it there because they would have also fell.
Exactly. Like, I don't even know how they got her body there without falling in the water. It makes you wonder.
It does make you wonder. And on top of that, too, like, I feel that the security guard
plays so much more.
He does. And I will tell you this much, and I've said it before, and I will continue saying it because of my job. You have the 5 W's. Who, what, when, where, and why. And if you have asked every one of those questions and you're still not getting a clear answer and something still isn't making sense, guess what? Somebody's still hiding something from you. Somebody's lying because they have information that they do not want to share.
Yeah.
And they will circle around that to keep from telling.
Yeah. And, like, I tried to send in a FOIA request. It did not work. Don't know if I did it right or if, like, they just didn't like open it, because this is still technically an open case. So like,
I
want to look at the files so bad, because like, this doesn't make sense.
And I will tell you another thing too. Why are they so sensitive about a sexual assault?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm sorry.
I guess because it was the 80s. Because like now, like it doesn't.
Even at that point.
Oh no, it wasn't the 80s. It was the 90s. It was 1990. Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, I just, there's a lot of things, because I mean, I'm sorry. If there is, let's just say she might have been the first case. What if there was more rapes going on? What if there was more sexual assaults going on? What if this could have been a serial killer out on the loose? So, I mean, I've got questions for the police department too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot on there. Her parents continued to hold on for hope until their deaths in 2005 and 2007. Funeral services for Lynn Priestley were held on Saturday, March 24th, 1990, at the Village Chapel Presbyterian Church in Kanawha City. The Reverend W.F. Mansell presided. Lynn Priestley was laid to rest in a mausoleum at the Woodmere Cemetery in Huntington the same day.
In 2015, on the 25th anniversary of Lynn's murder, the Charleston Chief of Police, Steve Cooper, again sounded basically an optimistic tone when he announced that the case had been revisited within the previous years, basically saying that the ongoing investigation was like a puzzle that was missing one or two pieces.
Gee, you don't say.
Right?
I'm sorry. I get so mad about stuff like this.
Same. As of 2026, the case of Lynn Priestley remains cold. I mean, during this case, there was a suspect or suspects in mind, but their names were never made public. And had to throw this out there. For a time, suspicion naturally fell on Thomas White. There was no indictment ever brought or sought against him. He has never made a public statement on this since 1990, which reminds me of another case where someone has only talked to police once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Stevens.
Mm-hmm. If you have any information on the murder of Lynn Priestley, please contact the Charleston, West Virginia Police Department at 304-348-6400.
We'll be back next week with a new case.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.